In an address to a gathering at New South Wales Parliament House in 2005 to celebrate the 175th anniversary of the appointment of the first Crown Prosecutor, Frederick Garling, Mark said that many of the extraordinary complex trials conducted over those 175 years, there was a serious contender for the trial of all trials, that of the so-called man-woman, Eugenia Fellini, in 1920. She was on trial for the murder of her first wife, and it was at a time when the barriers of gender were completely fixed and the idea of crossing them morally abhorrent. Mark Tedeschi, senior Crown Prosecutor, found the case so compelling that he's written a book about it called Eugenia, a true story of adversity, tragedy, crime and courage, and it will, of course, be a marvellously successful movie. Mark now joins me in the Sydney studio. Mark, welcome to the Little Wireless program.
Thank you, Philip.
Can you just give us the background to one of the most extraordinary cases anywhere in the world?
Look, it is an extraordinary case. Eugenia Fellini lived as a man for 22 years, and in that time legally married twice, and both wives were ignorant of the true identity of their husband, who went by the name of Harry Crawford. Harry Crawford worked as a man, married as a man, had a lot of male friends, would go to the pub drinking like a man, and lived a truly male life. And in today's world, we would call him a transsexual.
Of course, this followed up her youth, when she really was repulsed by her deemed sexuality in Italy.
She was born in Italy, and she spent most of her childhood and adolescence in New Zealand, where her very conservative Italian family had virtually no understanding of this strange daughter who wanted to be a male.
She was forced into marriage in Wellington to an Italian bloke, and that was, of course, a catastrophe.
Yes, indeed. Her father, in desperation, thinking that it might turn his daughter around, forced her into a marriage to a man who turned out to already have a family in Auckland, and he took his new wife up to Auckland, and she found out the truth, and I think he probably got as much of a surprise as she did. And she escaped immediately, came back to Wellington, and it was then that she started trying to live as a male, and in Wellington tried to get jobs in factories as a male. But so many people knew her that she was constantly discovered and exposed, was brought to court several times, and finally, in desperation, Eugenia took on a male identity as a seaman.
Well, that is where the story really becomes quite horrifying, because one day the ship's captain found out through a slip of language on her part that she was a woman, and the captain raped her, locked her up in the ship's store, continued to rape her periodically, and as you reveal in the book, after about 2 months she's forced to disembark at Newcastle, north of Sydney, alone, traumatised, destitute and pregnant.
Yes, indeed. And she had a daughter, Josephine. She went to Sydney, where she convinced a couple of Italian background to take on this daughter, and it was then that she commenced the 22 years living as Harry Crawford in Sydney, working as a labourer, as a rouseabout, working in pubs, and leading to Harry Crawford's two marriages.
And she's described in her childhood or in her youth as being a very beautiful young woman. And she becomes a pretty handsome bloke, who, and so with good looks and charm, he's popular with both men and women.
Yes, he was very popular. He was very good company, particularly after a few beers at a pub. His fellow workers liked him because he was a very good worker. He liked hard physical work and was strong and wiry. And women were very taken by his bonhomie and his good looks, and indeed by his sexual prowess.
Okay, now let's move the story along. In 1913, Harry Crawford marries Annie Burkett, a widow with a son who also happens to be called Harry, and they're married for 4 years before Annie found out that Harry was actually a woman. How did he bring this off? I think we're going to get into technical details about his extraordinary dildo.
The main reference to the dildo was at the 1920 trial, where it was merely described as the article. And it was an article that Harry had fashioned himself and with which he pleasured both his wives. And I go into some detail in the book as to how he made the article and how he used it successfully to keep both of his wives very contented.
So it's made of hardwood, leather straps, beautifully constructed, and he was able, under cover of darkness, to maintain a quite extraordinary illusion.
Yes, in those days, I think women knew a lot less about sex, and they were quite prepared for sexual contact to be in the dark under the covers and
with one position.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Now, it's daughter Josephine who one day in a fit of pique revealed the truth to a neighbour that her father was actually her mother dressed as a man. And this is how Annie, Harry's wife, found out.
Yes, Josephine knew pretty well all along that this man was actually her mother. Well, she'd certainly known from the age of seven, and she was constantly bombarded with threats of dire consequences if she ever revealed the truth. And for reasons that I go into in the book, at some stage in Josephine's mid-teen years, she had to come and live with Harry and Harry's wife, Annie Burkett.
Yeah.
And it was in that context that Josephine came to accidentally disclose the true identity of Harry Crawford.
Now, Mark, Annie was concerned that if the truth came out, she'd be a laughingstock, a social pariah. But she was more concerned that her son, Harry Jr., would be ostracised. He was about 14 at this stage. What did she decide to do about the marriage?
Well, she was in this terrible dilemma that she knew that, I mean, the divorce laws in those days were very strict. They had to be certain grounds and they had to be proven in a court, and it was all very technical, and there was a lot of media attention to divorces because they were quite rare. And Annie assessed quite accurately that if this whole story came out, she would become the laughing stock of the nation and it would affect her beloved young teenage son. So she was in this terrible dilemma of what to do, and she...
As was Harry, because he's still very much in love with her, desperate to keep the marriage together, and as you say, prepared to agree to any conditions that she wanted.
Yes, look, Harry's life quest was to live what he viewed as an authentic life as a male and to have the love of a wife. And he very much loved Annie and was very attracted to her and desperately wanted to keep their marriage together.
Now, the only way she could handle this, given the laws at the time, was to work on an annulment.
That was the conclusion that she eventually came to. It was the only way out, and she had devised in part a plan to try and extricate both of them from this situation that she found intolerable.
Okay, you point out that only two people know exactly what happened on the day Annie Burkett died in the Lane Cove River Park, but from the known facts, and with the benefit of today's forensic sciences, you've created what seems to me a very plausible version of events. Take us through it.
Look, I don't want to give too much away because it's quite complex and one really has to read the book to understand it. But the way that the trial unfolded, where Eugenia was charged with the murder of Annie Burkett, the Crown case depended very strongly on some forensic science from the two government pathologists who had conducted the post-mortem examination on Annie Birkett's body. And they came to certain conclusions about how she died. With the benefit of 100 years of forensic science, we now know that those conclusions were quite wrong. And ultimately, one can't say how Annie Birkett came to die. And because of that, I've come to the conclusion that if Eugenia's trial were held today, she would undoubtedly be, would not be convicted of murder. She would either be acquitted or at the very most convicted of manslaughter.
LNL on ABC Radio National, and I'm talking to Mark Tedeschi QC, Special Crown Prosecutor, author of Eugenia, and a very fine photographer, as it happens. Okay, I understand your reluctance to reveal all to the radio audience, although I promise you almost everyone's going to rush out and buy a copy of the book anyway. Let's, before we move on, try to describe the atmosphere in Sydney and at the time. You know, it was a society which was largely ignorant of sex, even straight sex.
Yes, it was. And there was no understanding of homosexuality or transsexualism. The newspapers went ballistic when Eugenia was first charged at this story of a woman who had lived as a man for such a long time and legally married twice. They treated her mercilessly in the press, and there was a tremendous amount of coverage about this very strange creature, and conjecture about how she'd managed to convince both wives that she was a male. So that by the time it came to her trial, there was already an enormous amount of prejudice against her, making it very hard for her to get a fair trial.
I think we should point out in parenthesis that it took a long time for Harry to get over what happened to Annie that day, but he did marry for the second time, and he managed to keep his gender a secret from the second wife as well.
Yes.
She even thought she was pregnant with her husband's child at one point.
Yes, well, when the police came and told her that they had charged her husband with the murder of his first wife, that was enough shock in itself, because she wasn't aware of this first wife. But when they then said to her that her husband was actually a female, she laughed at them and said that she knew that they were wrong because she was pregnant. She was quite convinced she was pregnant. It turned out that she was not, and it took her some weeks before she realised that what the police had told her was correct.
Mark, there's only one trial that I can recall which provoked such a media frenzy and such demonising of someone, and that's the Lindy Chamberlain trial.
I think that there are some parallels in the way that the media unfairly mistreated both accused persons. So I think there are some parallels. I would like to think that if Eugenia went for trial today, that things would be very different. I think that there'd be a lot more understanding in the media and in the community generally for a transsexual. And of course, there are some major differences in the way that her trial would be conducted if it was held today.
Well, of course, the transsexuality was confused with homosexuality. The law against homosexuality at the time was fairly tough, wasn't it?
Yes. The attitude to homosexuality was very, very strange. It was the study of homosexuality was very much in its infancy at the time. And the general view at that time was to conflate homosexuality and transsexualism, so that if a person was a homosexual, it was because they were considered in some respect to be in some ways part of the opposite sex. So that was the way that they conflated those two concepts.
Let's talk about the atrocious article, your term, from The Sun of the 14th of July 1920. If Eugenia Valerie has been designated the man-woman, were taken into the forum like the Romans were in bygone days. Probably the whole of the metropolis would turn out to get a glimpse of her. This was the impression conveyed by the huge crowd that assembled at the central police court this morning. The trial must have been a horrendous experience for Eugenia.
Yes, it was a horror. There were long queues of people trying to get into the courtroom to get a glimpse of her, mainly women, surprisingly. There was a very large throng of media from around Australia. It was reported in every newspaper throughout Australia. It was reported all over New Zealand. It was even reported in Italy, the land of her birth. And
she would have been so lonely because her relationship with her Italian family had been broken off decades before, hadn't it?
That's right.
Did she have any friends, any supporters?
Look, I think at the time of her trial, she was probably entirely on her own. She'd lost contact with her second wife, whom she dearly, dearly loved. Annie, of course, had died.
What about the daughter? What about Josephine?
The daughter wanted nothing to do with her at that stage. It was such a terrible trauma for the daughter. The daughter gave evidence in the committal proceedings, desperately didn't want to be there, was forced to be there by a subpoena, and came into court with a veil over her face so that nobody could take photographs of her, even in the courtroom, and just bawled her eyes out whilst giving evidence in the committal proceedings, and then disappeared and couldn't be found at the time of the trial.
Mark, how was Eugenia dressed in the court?
Oh, look, that was quoted at enormous length in the newspaper reports. I don't remember exactly now what she was wearing.
But she wasn't allowed to present herself in male attire, I presume.
Look, when she first appeared in court for her first mention, she was still dressed in the male clothes of Harry Crawford, which were the clothes that she was in when she was arrested by the police at the hotel where she was working. By the time it came to her trial, she wore female clothing, no doubt on the advice of her barrister, so as not to antagonise the jurors even further.
Now, okay, you're telling us that she wouldn't, if retried today in the light of current attitudes and law, she wouldn't be found guilty of murder, but yes, perhaps of manslaughter. I know you don't want to reveal all, but you've got to explain this to me, to some extent at least.
Well, manslaughter is a charge that is appropriate to a situation where one person commits an act of force or violence towards another person without any intention to kill them or to do them serious bodily injury. So it's an act of violence that results in the other person's death, unintended death, without that intention. And my conjecture, based upon a modern-day view of the forensic evidence and upon all of the other evidence, is that at the very most, this would have been an act of manslaughter and a tragic unintended death.
Now, you, of course, speak with great authority because you're drawing your views from 35 years of experience prosecuting some of Australia's most notorious crims, including Ivan Milat.
Yep.
Is this book, to some extent, therapeutic for you?
Look, I took long service leave to write it, and I must admit it was one of the most fun things that I've ever done in my life. I really enjoyed writing it, and I'm quite sure that I'm going to continue. I'll write another one, again a historical case. I didn't know whether I'd be able to write the emotional parts of it, the emotional interchanges, the emotional thoughts, and the conversations between people.
Well, you've got to get inside the body, literally, of a very complex, sexually complex human being.
Yes, that's
not
right.
Easy to do.
It wasn't, and I'd never done anything like that before. So, and I must admit, that was the part that I enjoyed the most. It was firmly based upon the evidence that was led at the trial and upon the other factual material that we had from newspapers and other sources. But one had to some degree, where the precise facts were not known, at times one had to make an educated assumption what must have happened.
Mark, what happened to Harry?
Harry Jr.?
Senior. Eugene.
Harry Senior. Harry Senior, went to trial. Eugenia went to trial and then was convicted of the murder of Annie Birkett and was sentenced to death. The death sentence was commuted. And
why commuted? Given the extraordinary row, you know, the fuss around the trial, a commutation doesn't sound probable.
Look, by 1920, there were very few executions, even of murderers, and there hadn't been an execution of a female for, I think, more than 20 years at that time.
So the sex that she denied may, in fact, have saved her.
Indeed. Yes.
There's a paradox, isn't
it? Yes, that's quite right. Yes.
So, commuted, what and how long in the slammer?
The first part of the book is about Eugenia's life before her trial. The second part is about the trial itself. And the third part is about her life in custody, where she had some very important things that happened to her in her life. And then after serving 8 years, her sentence was, she was paroled. And I then go on to describe her life after she was granted parole.
Well, your timing's good. As you know, they're one of the runner-ups for the Oscar this year, told the story of a woman masquerading as a man, as a butler, in a, you know, a mansion in Dublin, as I recall.
Yes.
So these days, this sort of sexual complexity is almost fashionable. So I reckon there will be a film version. Mark, thanks for coming in.
Thank
Mark's
you,
book
Philip.
Eugenia, A True Story of Adversity, Tragedy, Crime and Courage. He thinks it's one of the most extraordinary cases in the last 175 years. It's published by Simon and Schuster. This is LNL on RN, and now we're going to tell you the suppressed secret story of the RAF with the Russians.